Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second of the Radner Lectures for 1973. My name is Alan Weston, and I'm this evening representing the Department of Public Law and Government, and have the distinct pleasure of presenting Bayard Rustin to carry us from where last night he left off in describing the roots of the protest movements of the last two decades in a sketch of civil rights activities in the United States between 1909 and 1954, in which he did exactly what the university hoped he would, to bring together his own personal experiences with the major leaders of Negro politics and protest movements in the years between the First and the Second World Wars, to give us the advantage of his insights into the personalities, the intellectual positions, and the strategic and tactical approaches of the major leaders who laid the foundations for the post-World War II thrust in civil rights protest. This evening, in his second lecture, he presents to us a memoir of the 1960s, in which his own role was so central with Dr. Martin Luther King in the Montgomery bus boycott in the late 50s, into the major civil rights activities leading to the March on Washington, passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, 1965, and an interpretation of the milieu in which the new protest activities went forward and accomplished so much in this period. Last night he began by apologizing to his old friends that they might be surprised to see him reading a lot and his hands not waving as much as they were used to. We talked about that afterwards and decided that trying to get him to stay with the text was like trying to bottle up the Mississippi. And he promised that this evening his hands would wave more and he would give us more of his own personal observations and reflections on the period in which he was so centrally involved. So again, it is Columbia University's honor to present to you Mr. Bayard Rustin.
Thank you. Actually, what I did last night has been rather fully described, but I would like to add one thing. What I, in fact, attempted to do was not to deal with all the people and all the organizations which helped make this fight from 1909 to 1953 a success. I selected that organization, the NAACP, and that individual, A. Philip Randolph, who represented the thought and process of political reality that made what happened happen. I pointed out that the NAACP stayed in the courts relentlessly. And I pointed out that Mr. A. Philip Randolph was periodically in the streets with masses of people, because he knew that you could not get a political breakthrough because you begged for it, but because you built your politics on the working class black people. I pointed out that Mr. Randolph rejected the three dominant trends of black people of the period. Not only did he reject Booker Washington's accommodation, let down your buckets where you are, which is to say, don't struggle. He rejected the notion of the talented tenth because it didn't represent power. He rejected Garvey, who was a reactionary. And the NAACP stayed in the courts while Randolph pointed out to black people and made an example for King and others who were to come in the period I shall discuss tonight as to how progress can come. Now tonight, I am going to concentrate fundamentally on Martin Luther King. There were hundreds of other people who were playing a role. There were many organizations which were playing a role. But I am out to analyze what was the central trend from 1954 until 1964. Now, the 50s were usually characterized as a decade of apathy, highlighted by McCarthyism, the mediocrity of the Eisenhower administration, and the narrowing of America's political vision. Certainly no one could have believed that a protest or a revolutionary movement could have emerged in the 50s. And in fact, it seemed at the decade's outset that the civil rights agenda would not move at all. The expectations which were raised in 1948 by Harry Truman's racial programs were dashed by a Congress dominated by the Southern Bloc, which did nothing. A vacuum was left by the radical political movements who had had ideological influence. The radical parties never fared well in electoral politics. Their role always had been of theoretical political value. And they had been tireless in pointing out the injustices of the capitalist system and calling for legislation that would stop social abuses. They fought child labor. They fought for Social Security, for labor legislation, unemployment compensation. Demands like these had formed the substance of the socialist program for years, and they had ultimately been transformed into law. But now the radical parties were impotent, having succumbed to the mistaken assumptions that they held about the American society, and because they simply refused to recognize the true nature of McCarthy. Now, when the Democratic Party, civil rights plank was set up in 48 convention, nothing happened because the mantle of that leadership then passed to those individuals who had absolutely no feeling for race. To Adlai Stevenson, the so-called liberal, the struggle against racial discrimination was more a potential liability than an opportunity to move forward. In fact, he did not even insist or make an effort to get blacks involved in his campaigns. In addition, in 1952, in a gesture to appease the South, he turns towards Sparkman for his running mate. The Democratic Party's 1952 platform did not even mention that black people existed in this country. And yet, my friends, in the face of this, a miracle was about to happen. And just as Lenin had been sitting in Switzerland writing about how the revolution could not come, and some women stand up because they're cold in a factory and march into the street, and we are faced with one of the great revolutions of all times, so in the face of the American political cesspool of the 50s, something magnificent broke forth. Now, amongst the major institutions of government, only the courts did not reflect this weakening. And all credit to the NAACP, who stuck with this problem for 50 years, adhering to the patterns established in the late 30s and 40s, the Supreme Court continued to hand down decisions which hastened the desegregation process. In 1948, the High Court ordered the state of Oklahoma to provide law school facilities for Negroes. 2 years later, it directed Oklahoma to end segregation of the graduate school. A year later, it ordered the University of Texas to integrate the law school. And at that moment, the bubble bursts. At that moment, then, at that great moment, came the Brown decision and ruled the segregated school system violated the equal protection of the 14th Amendment. Now, I am not a lawyer, and if I were, I should not go into the implications of the legal aspect. However, I think it is important to understand a few of the Brown decision's political and social consequences. After 50 long years of struggle, The Brown decision was important, and for the following reasons. First, it was the first time since Reconstruction that blacks were declared full citizens under law. The Brown decision was important because it automatically made every family in the land a part of the struggle for or against civil rights. Because once you touch the schoolhouse, you have brought in the total population. Nobody can now say he's uninterested. It forced the states to confront black demands for the first time since Reconstruction. It challenged Southern political power for the first time since Reconstruction. It forced the South, not Martin Luther King. All over the universities there are courses about Martin Luther King's civil disobedience. The fact is, King never engaged in any civil disobedience. The Brown decision forced the Southern states to engage in civil disobedience. And what King did was a great help, because now people saw black protesters upholding the Supreme Court. We became the symbols of law and order. Furthermore, it isolated the South politically. Nobody could openly say they were right. Oh, they made deals in Congress, but nobody could say it openly. It made the highest court a friend of black people. That is to say, it gave blacks confidence. And that confidence was a passport into mass action. Mrs. Parks may have sat down a year after the decision, but without that decision, 50,000 people would not have gone to her aid. And I can tell you, because a lot of us had been sitting down in the front of those buses for a long time and nobody came. Now, that is to say, it all began when Rosa Parks sat down. And my friends, for fear you have forgotten, may I trace for you the highlights of that 10-year period after Rosa Parks sat. Emmett Till was lynched in Mississippi in 1955. The Montgomery bus protest begins. SCLC is founded the next year, 1956. 1957, we have Little Rock. We have the prayer pilgrimage. We have the Civil Rights Act passed, the first since 1875. 1958, Randolph sets up the first youth march for integrated schools. 1959, we have the second youth march. 45,000 people organized by a handful of Yipsels and me, but they go to Washington. 1960, John Kennedy calls Mrs. King, is elected president because blacks made him president. The sit-ins begin in 60. For the next 3 years, there are massive demonstrations throughout the South. Lunch counters are integrated. Department stores are integrated. Whole colleges are closed down. Jails are filled. 1963, demonstrations now involve whole communities rising up, adults and children as well as students. Number two, Jackson, Mississippi, massive demonstrations. The assassination of Medgar Evers. CORE starts protesting in the North, starting out primarily in the building trades, in the cities. Martin Luther King organizes massive demonstrations in Birmingham. The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom comes off. 1964, the passage of the first effective Civil Rights Act. There are riots in Harlem. A couple of weeks later, Cheney, Swearengen, and Goodman are killed in Mississippi. The Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party challenges the whole Dixiecrat demonstration and keeps them from getting seated in Atlantic City. Civil rights leaders call a moratorium, and not a single person failed to adhere to it, because they said rather to stay out of the streets than to elect Barry Goldwater. Humphrey made civil rights the important issue in 48, and he led the 1964 Act through the Congress. 1965, Montgomery to Selma, the passage of the Voter Rights Act. Lyndon Johnson tells the United States Senate that we shall overcome. On top of that, we get to race riots. The next year, we get to march in Mississippi. Black power emerges as a slogan. Dr. King goes to Chicago. 1967, a long, hot summer in Newark, Detroit, etc., etc. And 1968, the man whom I have come to discuss most tonight is killed. What a momentous 10 years. And how marvelously beautiful the people were who engaged in it. When one thinks of the courage and the perseverance of the people who stood with King, of the people who stood with SNCC, of the people who died and were shot and whose homes were bombed, it is a magnificent story worth analyzing. How did the Montgomery protest begin? It began because Rosa Parks went over to speak to E.D. Nixon and to explain to him how she had been insulted in the bus. And E.D. Nixon, an old, gnarled hand Pullman porter, who, what with carrying bags and arthritis, could scarcely use his hands, sat up and wrote one of the most magnificent leaflets ever written, with every other word misspelled. But it said, Rosa Parks has been mistreated and we've got to stay off those buses. That night he showed this leaflet to his wife and she said, man, you are out of your mind. Number one, these white folks are going to beat you up, and number two, these colored folks are not going to pay attention to your leaflet. These people have got to work. But E.D. Nixon persevered and he called a meeting. Now, this is one of the most interesting meetings of all time. E.D. Nixon calls the ministers, 20 of them in front of him. He says, I don't have the education. I'm not a Randolph. I can't lead the movement. You got to do it. And all the ministers in the front row were hoping that they would be selected. And he looked at him and said, I don't want anybody on this side of the room to lead this meeting because you've been here too long. People don't like you. They got something against you. I tell you who I want to lead the meeting. This fellow over here, Dr. King, who just came here a couple of months ago with his wife, I want him to lead it. They said, why do you want that young fellow to lead it? He said, because he ain't got no scars. The rest of you are all scarred up. Dr. King stood up and said, now, Mr. Nixon, you know I've had no experience like this. I can't do this. And he said to Dr. King, huh? I know the old ones are cowards. I didn't expect you to be. Dr. King said, now, Mr. Nixon, it's not fair for you to call me a coward. He said, if you don't lead this meeting, it's fair for me to call you a coward. And Dr. King stumbled up and said, I'll try. That's how it began. King reluctantly accepted, and the marvelous of his reluctance was later to be seen in his total humility. He did not want to be begged. He honestly did not think that he could take on so great a responsibility. Next, what were the factors that made Montgomery possible at this moment when it had not ever been possible before for 50,000 people to rise up? Well, it's very simple, my friends. The South was going through the process of urbanization, which brought 50,000 people to Montgomery. They weren't out as sharecroppers, where somebody could put a sheet over their head and scare them to death. One of the most glorious moments in the Montgomery protest to me was when Dr. King got word that the Ku Klux Klan was riding on the town with their sheets, their dirty automobiles, and some coming on horseback. And Dr. King said, let's go. I said, where are we going, Martin? He said, we're going to get our brothers out, and when the Ku Klux Klan comes through, we're going to stand up and applaud them. They were so embarrassed, they left. But that was urbanization, not just the good spirit of black people. We had always wanted to fight back. Second of all, there was industrialization. And industrialization brought to Alabama unionization. Thus, when Dr. King needed automobiles, when they began to take them, he had no problem. He simply had to go to Birmingham, where the steel workers were organized, ask the brothers for some cars, and got them. But wouldn't it look silly going down to the cotton fields asking for some mules to take the people around?
wouldn't have worked. Furthermore, the people of Montgomery were educated and fairly independent and could make up their own minds. They were not sharecroppers who could be starved out tomorrow. These are the four things that King had as against the lack of education, the rural existence, the poverty, the sharecropping, and the lynching and terror. Now, even the nature of brutality had to change for the good and for the worse. A Ku Klux Klan is good in an urban situation, but it won't work in town. That is the reason King was the stimulator of the setting up of the Citizens Council. Yeah, that's exactly what did it. Now let's see how the protest grew. It's very important to see how it happened. It fundamentally was not organized by King as much as it was organized by the mistakes of the white power structure. That is not to take anything away from King, but it is to show what magnificent assistance he got from the ignoramus. At first, there were just a few church women who came out. Then they made their first mistake. A young man was helping an elderly lady across the street in a proposition where the word had gone around that King was going to have goons to keep people off the buses. They arrested that young man, who happened to be captain of the football team at Alabama State, that brought in every college student overnight. 2 weeks later, when Martin was a little fearful that things might not go well, they began to take from the black bourgeoisie something you do not touch with the black bourgeoisie. They went out and began to pick up these people's automobiles. That brought all the bourgeoisie into the movement. At this point, you got that sociological thing which is so interesting. And that is to say, when you're trying to build a movement, the minute you get 51%, you've got 100%. Because it has now become the thing to do. And they're in. King got to the 51% tipping point by the most fantastic sensibilities. And that brings me directly to the significance of Martin Luther King. King was a genius. It is amazing the tremendous political insights he had without ever having been in any political movement. He just somehow smelled the right thing to do. I shall never forget at the prayer pilgrimage, I said, "Martin, your speech is rotten. You standing up there in front of all these brothers talking about, give us the vote, give us the vote." I said, "The mood today, Martin, is you've got to say to the brother, we demand the vote." King looked at me and he said, "Well, let me think about it overnight." When he never came back to me, I knew he was completely ignoring me. The next day he stood up and said, "Give us the vote," and it was the most magnificent speech to that time. He sensed these things. Furthermore, he was a preacher and came from a long family of preachers, by which I mean that he had been forced all his life to watch the way people behaved and to bring them around. If the Negro preacher had anything to do besides preaching, that's what he had to do. King always kept his eye on his lieutenants. And sometimes I say, "Well, you know, Martin, do you think it's necessary to spend all that time?" And he say, "Well, I want to take Reverend C with me. You know, he's got problems." And I say, "Oh, I don't think it's important." He say, "It's important." He was ideal. He was young. He was educated. He was a family man. And as Nixon said, he didn't have scars. In addition, he was a brilliant spokesman. He could move people with a spoken word. But in addition, he was a man of humility. The day J. Edgar Hoover called him the biggest liar on earth, I can assure you we spent 2 hours, 10 of us, in 10 cities, talking to Martin Luther King. And there is a gentleman in this room who was on that telephone with us. And many of us were so angry with J. Edgar Hoover that we told Martin, look, stand up, fight back, don't let him get away with this. And Martin again said, well, let me think it over. The next day, Martin quietly went to the department, presented himself to J. Edgar Hoover, and from that moment on, J. Edgar Hoover looked as ridiculous, calling Martin Luther King the biggest liar, because he had no evidence of it whatsoever, because if he had, he would have been forced to produce it. Martin Luther King won the Nobel Prize, and thereby giving to every black man in this country a sense of worldwide dignity. And I was there when he received the prize. And almost every black face in that audience had tears coming down its face. Martin Luther King forced Southern businessmen to desert the White Citizens Council and to come out and to be the strongest element in the 60s, urging politicians to stop segregation. That is to say, he drove a wedge between white business and white politicians in the South. But now I come to Martin Luther King's great contribution. Martin Luther King advanced the strategies and tactics of nonviolence far beyond anything Gandhi ever did. For Gandhi was working with a great majority against a small minority. Gandhi had the backbenchers of the Labour Party with him for 20 years. King had, when he began, very few people in the Congress behind him. And King proved what Gandhi did not have the opportunity to prove, that a minority adhering to nonviolence can be as effective in bringing about change as Gandhi's majority was. And that is the ultimate reason that Martin Luther King will go down in history. Now, people often wonder, why did ministers have to lead? Ministers had to lead for a very simple reason. The church was the only institution in the black community that was in touch with the total black masses. It was the only institution indigenous to the Negro community. Even the pool rooms and bars were owned by white people. The church was economically independent because it got its money. And therefore, except for terror, Southern power had no leverage on the black church. But strategically, ministers were urgent because when you had as many daily crises and emergencies, jailings, lawsuits, you had to have people who had had experience with autonomy. And if you know anything, Baptist ministers are fairly autonomous. All right, I'm going to come next to another facet. And that was, even if Martin had been what he had been, even if all blacks had done what they had done, even if whites had come into the South to help, without the mass media, Montgomery would not have been possible. I say to you, my friends, if we had had television 30 years earlier, we would have stopped lynching 30 years earlier. Here, for the first time, the television was showing people being beaten. It was showing blacks nonviolent while being beaten. It was showing that we were underdogs, that the children were being brutalized. They saw people being killed, and they saw brutal whites doing terrible things to children. The television was a decidedly vital factor in creating a consensus for change. Now, of course, the television did not show in the 50s and 60s mob violence a la the lynching. Because King had 50,000 people on the street, when you bombed his home, that was not mob violence. That was political terror, because he is now in a political movement. And Americans may be prepared even to see some mob violence on the television and not be moved. But they know that they are in trouble when they see political terror, and how magnificently Martin handled the terror that was visited upon him as he went across the South, as his home was bombed, and as he was fearful for his children. Now, if you get the television on your side because you are nonviolent, because you are underdog, because you are being brutalized, because you are being killed, the minute the press needs another image, and there goes about making 15-minute leaders because they have something violent to say, who pick up the Black Power slogan, who talk about black violence and black rhetoric, then, of course, what you get in a little later period is a backlash. I mention this only to mention again the total genius of King, that he was able to keep 50,000 people from a single act of violence or a single word of rhetoric that was wrong. And until this day, my friends, there are three classic pieces of literature which will go down in the United States as great. Harrison Salisbury's pieces from Birmingham, Murray Kempton's 6 to 7 pieces on Martin Luther King, and Claude Sitton doggedly following the SNCC kids around Mississippi and reporting in the New York Times, the most glorious newspaper writing of our time. I recommend those to anyone truly interested. Now let us see what Montgomery did. And I use the term Montgomery here to mean all the SNCC kids and what they did and all the other protests that were going on, because it was all of a pattern. And as I said at the beginning, I concentrate on King because he was a symbol. It brought self-respect to black people. When I first got to Montgomery, about a week after all had begun, a little wizened woman called me over to the back of the church. She says, "Young man, you're much older than Dr. King." I said, "Yes." She said, "I do hope you'll talk some sense to him. Dr. King knows these colored folks are not going to cling together. Why is he starting this thing to fail? He just came here. We want to see him succeed." I said, "Madam, why don't you give Dr. King a chance? Maybe he knows something we don't know." She shook her head and walked away. 2 months later, that woman was working harder than anybody else on the transportation committee, and I don't know where she got cars from sometimes. I think she vomited them. She had gained a new self-respect. Secondly, imagine for 1 year black people and white people over the country hearing that people have walked to work every day, that they themselves are collecting nickels and dimes to pay for the movement, that they're being offered rides and not taking them, day after day after day. That year of struggle created all of the protest which followed it, because it had reestablished the possibility of winning. It was the first Southern protest ever to include human demands and demands that were economic. And how simple they seem now, and how absolutely radical they were then. All Dr. King was asking for was abolition of segregation, end of abusive behavior on the part of white bus drivers, and the hiring of a half dozen or so black drivers. But one of the interesting things is that as the year went on and Dr. King was more confident and the people felt better, they escalated and escalated and escalated their demands, and at the end of it they were saying, all segregation must go and blacks must be treated in the marketplace like anyone else. I'll be finished soon. Now, Dr. King's next moment of genius was to form SCLC. And here again, Dr. King and Stanley Levinson, who's sitting over here, and I were all talking. And somehow or other, we all came to a conclusion. You can't win in Montgomery unless you've got protests all over the South. And therefore, we got to go out and organize protests all over the South. But they can't win if Montgomery doesn't win first. That led to the forming of the SCLC. That is to say, Dr. King formed SCLC because he had to sustain the spirit of Montgomery and spread it across the South. Now, this he did when his back is to the wall. And brother, let me tell you, Abernathy King and I were in the basement of Abernathy's church getting ready to drive over to Memphis for the first meeting of SCLC, going over the last plans. We all left the church at 4:15 in the morning, thank God, because at 4:30 the place was blown up. But he went, despite this. Abernathy went, despite the fact his church was being blown up, because he had to maintain the psychological initiative. And SCLC became the dynamic center of the movement for 10 years. Now, my friends, then something else began to happen. SCLC was essentially a working class movement. It was created by ordinary house servants, by E.D. Nixon, a Pullman porter, by Rosa Parks, who made a living selling for white folks, by women who washed clothes for white people. SNCC emerged and takes us another step forward, because SNCC was not a working class movement, nor was it basically a student movement. SNCC was a black bourgeoisie movement. Now, all of SNCC's kids' parents had money. They had cars and they owned houses. They couldn't drive the cars anywhere and get anything to eat. When they came to see the students in college, they couldn't take them out for a hamburger. They couldn't take the kids to a movie. And so this black middle class, owning their homes, owning cars, all educated, could not move. And they could not move because they didn't have enough money both to send their kids to college and take a chance on losing the house fighting the white folks. So the SNCC kids rose up, and there was in the SNCC thing a revolution of the black bourgeoisie by proxy. Their children did it for them. And even the things they attacked were the things that their parents needed going into theaters and hotels when they were traveling around in their cars. Now, SNCC was also magnificent, not only because they were courageous, and not only because they had perseverance. They would just put their little behinds on the seat and stay until they were dragged away. And they'd come back and sit again. And they'd get arrested, and they'd come back and sit. And somebody would put a cigarette butt down the girl's back or in her breast. And she'd fish it out and sit. But they were also experiential. They had a great need to stretch themselves. They played with participatory democracy. sometimes till 6 or 7 in the morning, trying to decide who would do the dishes. But this was a good thing at the beginning. They experimented with making sharecroppers leaders of revolutionary movements. They experimented with community living, Catholic, Protestant, Jew, black and white together. Now they also faced some problems. One of them was a youth leadership changes very rapidly. But they did arouse youth all over this world, and they restored to youth, not only in the United States, but all over Europe, the will to political and social action again. No youth could stand still in the face of the injustices in his own neighborhood or community. Everybody wanted to go down to Mississippi to live with the SNCC kids. Now, SNCC failed, ultimately. But it failed out of the goodness of its efforts to try. They did not know that you cannot make leaders for revolution out of people who have had just a sharecropping experience. The minute Moses attempted to turn SNCC over to people who had that limited experience, it was bound to fail. Secondly, participatory democracy made decision-making too lengthy, so that often the need for the decision was over before it had been made. There was a suffering from absolutism, but if you have to go through what they did, there is a tendency for you to become absolutist, because we absolutely have got to stay here and stay here until this thing disappears. But there's a complication. Don't talk to me about the complication. I'm here. But there is an analysis you have. Don't tell me about an analysis. I'm going to sit here till we break this thing down. Now, my friends, SNCC has largely gone. But never was there a greater and more noble moment in the history of any young people than this moment. Now, let us look at the March on Washington, another highlight of this period, and see what it achieved. It achieved a consensus leading to a national support for black objectives in the Congress. Before the march, few people thought that civil rights was the most pressing problem, that is, in Congress. After the march, a decisive majority of Congress was convinced that there had now to be legislation. It was after this that Kennedy said, "Now I understand we must do something to get them out of the streets." It was based on a sound political philosophy and intelligent, responsible strategy. It was strictly nonviolent. It had a broad program of and a positive response from the majority of Americans, Catholics, Protestants, Jews, labor, students, liberals, everybody was there. Even my good friend who spent 2 months denouncing the march as being a useful thing that he would not go to. On the night before, Malcolm called up and said he thought he was coming after all. And he did come. Everybody was there. The program was not utopian. It could be readily translated into legislation. In fact, most of the 10 demands have already been written into law. King's speech will linger forever along with the Gettysburg Address and a few others for all young people to read and to understand and to be inspired by. It was a time of unity. Now, as the march represented the high point of an era, the 1964 Democratic Party National Convention marked the symbolic conclusion of the period. What Martin Luther King had done during these years was to demonstrate, and this beyond Gandhi, that you could simultaneously destroy an evil institution and leave a good institution in its place. Here's a lunch counter. You sit and sit and sit and sit, and you just don't put the lunch counter out of business. They finally say to you, come on in, and we'll eat together. He went into parks and sat and sat and sat. And people said, then we won't use parks. But 6 months later, they said, they're still sitting there. Let's use parks. This is a genius to destroy an evil institution and to create a creative one in one fell swoop. Now, I conclude this talk by looking at the MFDP, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, because I have called what happened there the symbolic conclusion of the King period. That is the exclusively direct action period. You will remember that the SNCC people fanned out across Mississippi, urged people to vote, set up a Freedom Democratic Party, brought people in from all over the country to be a part of that great experiment. And then came 64, and they come to Atlantic City, where they are going to have to make a great decision. They all want to go in. I don't blame them. If I'd been through in Mississippi what they'd been through, I would have wanted to go in too. But the Southerners were there, they wanted to go in, and there was a stalemate. And in fact, Walter Ruther, Martin King, and I met with the SNCC leadership. We said, they've given you a compromise. The compromise is that the regular Mississippi Democrats do not get seated. Neither do you get seated. But you get two delegates who will be on the floor as observers. Either of those two observers will be given 1 hour of prime time at night on the platform to speak to all delegates and to the nation. And we promise you that racial discrimination will be outlawed in all future conventions. And for their own good reasons, against the will of King and Ruther and myself and many others, the kids decided the hell with it. They had come there for everybody to get seated, and if they weren't going to seat everybody, then they weren't going in. I happen to believe this was a great mistake, and I would like to tell you why. Let me put it another way. If this had been adults behaving, it would have been a serious mistake. For young people who had not had this kind of experience, it was a minor mistake, but it was a very serious one, nevertheless. What SNCC attempted to do was, it could not realize that the tactics which had been appropriate to tearing down an evil institution and creating a good one, that those tactics were only good for public accommodations, but could not be used if you were going to fight to get into a political party. They became absolutist at that point. And therefore, from then on, SNCC, which was attempting to use tactics for the period that I have just described, could not use those tactics for the period about which I will speak tomorrow evening. Thank you.